Welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics, and focus on the Middle East tonight. Didn't actually intend it this way, but it just sort of happened. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Dan Fleshler, who is the author of a new book called Transforming America's Israel Lobby, just published by Potomac Books. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview recorded earlier in the day with Hamid Dabashi, who is a professor of Iranian studies and comparative literature at Columbia. And I've had him on the show several times before to talk about Iranian affairs and talk to him about what's going on with the election and the subsequent demonstrations. And always interesting and sophisticated analysis from Hamid Dabashi. Before all that, just a few words of the economic news, since we've got a lot on tap today. In the U.S., some further signs that the carnage in the job market might be easing. First-time claims for unemployment insurance rose by 3,000 last week, which is a disappointing reversal of its recent declining trend. But the count of those still drawing jobless benefits, so-called continuing claims, fell by almost 150,000, the first decline in that measure since January, and a significant one at that. And the year-to-year percentage change in continuing claims declined for the first time in a year. Let me expand on that just a little bit. In May, continuing claims are up 118% from a year earlier, quite a big number. So far in June, they're up 114%. That's still a big number, as is the absolute level of continuing claims. Nearly 7 million people are drawing jobless benefits. But the movements in the yearly percentage change figures are often quite important. As I've been saying here for several weeks, the decline in the rate of growth in first-time claims since March has been very encouraging, since that's just the sort of thing you start seeing as a recession is drawing to a close. But continuing claims remain stubbornly high. Now the rate of change is falling, and that is the first sign of a break in that measure, too. And another piece of good news, the Conference Board's Index of Leading Indicators, which foretell movements in the broad economy 3 to 6 months out, rose strongly in May, its second consecutive healthy increase. That suggests the economy could begin turning around in the fall. Before breaking out the champagne and the noisemakers, though, I want to emphasize that these are early signs, and what the abstraction called the economy does isn't necessarily related directly to the lives of real people. It's probably going to take a year or more before the job market starts showing signs of life, even if GDP starts turning positive later this year. And even when the recession formally ends, which it almost certainly hasn't as of today, it's going to feel like a slump to many people for a long time afterwards. Perversely, though, the tentative signs of stabilization slash recovery are leading orthodox sorts, bond vigilantes on our trading desks here and European finance ministers and central bankers across the Atlantic, to talk more loudly about the need to tighten up policy. The fear is that all the stimulus coming from indulgent central banks and big spending governments is going to lead to inflation. This is dangerous lunacy. The only reason that we can even begin talking about the possibility of stabilization slash recovery is that all that government stimulus, take it away, and the economy, ours and almost everyone else's, would resume its cascade down the tubes. On Wednesday, we learned that the U.S. consumer prices in May were down 1% from a year earlier. All the gyrations in energy prices over the last couple of years have made it hard to read that headline CPI, but if you strip out food and energy, which prices of which tend to bounce all over the place, the CPI is up just 1.8% over the last year and showing no signs of accelerating. That's a very modest rate of inflation, and if anything, it's pointing down. With the economy flat in its back and likely to rise only very slowly, worrying about inflation right now should be a capital offense. This isn't the time or place for an extended analysis of the Obama administration's proposal for financial regulation released earlier in the week. I'll just say that they're pretty weak tea. There are a couple of good elements to it, a bit more disclosure on and regulation of certain kinds of derivatives, for example. But the proposed regs would allow banks to escape those rules by creating more and more custom derivatives. Bankers know how to game a system, and this system, as the administration is proposing, looks designed to be gamed. Giving more power to the Federal Reserve to regulate and supervise the financial market sounds nice, but they certainly didn't distinguish themselves during the stock bubble of the late 90s or the housing bubble of the early 2000s. So why they should do any better in the future is anyone's guess. As for the broader goal of regulating finance so tightly that it becomes as boring as a utility business was in the days before that industry got deregulated, well, that's just not going to happen. Wall Street will no doubt moan about even the slightest tightening of regulation, and they'll be all over Congress as these proposals work their way through that august body. But pay no attention to those moans. It looks like it's going to be business almost as usual. And finally, some more words on the outside world. I noted last week the economic troubles of Latvia and the other Baltic countries. They're experiencing about the worst of the global recession. Most Latvians, for example, are taking 10 to 20% pay cuts, those, that is, who haven't lost their jobs. I thought it'd be interesting to compile a roster of international distress based on the IMF's projected GDP growth rates for 2009. Economic forecasts from the IMF and just about everyone else are often worthless, especially when they're forecasts of the future. But their forecasts of the present are usually pretty good. For this year, the IMF projects that Latvia's economy will shrink by 12%, an enormous number, the worst of all the 180 countries for which it's made projections. Next up is Iceland, slated to decline around 11%. Then Botswana, down 10%. Also down 10%, the other Baltics, Estonia and Lithuania, and Singapore, which normally isn't found high up on rosters of distress. Other countries projected to take big hits are Ukraine, Ireland and Taiwan, all down around 8%, Japan, Russia and Germany, all down around 6%, and the UK, Denmark, Sweden and Korea, all down around 4%. The U.S., which sort of started all this, is actually number 44 on the IMF's projected list, ranging from the worst to the best, projected to be down just around 3% this year, around the level of France, Jamaica, and Canada. China is projected to be up over 6% this year. This is a deep global recession, but the U.S. is far from getting the worst of it. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about the Israel lobby with Dan Fleshler. And that, Antenna from the splendid new album by the tremendous group Sonic Youth. I love those guys. And now we're joined in the studio by Dan Fleshler, who is the author of Transforming America's Israel Lobby, The Limits of Its Power and the Potential for Change, just published by Potomac Books. Welcome to Behind the News, Dan.
Thank you for having me.
So how'd you get, let's give the radio CV, how'd you come to write this book?
Well, for about 20 years, a little more than 20 years, I was a volunteer and occasionally working professionally on behalf of a variety of left-leaning American Jewish groups that were trying to fight the occupation and build support for the peace camp in Israel. And in doing so, became pretty familiar with the mainstream American Jewish community. And at a certain point, it was actually an AIPAC policy conference in 2005, which I attended, where Dick Cheney stood up and gave the most bellicose, hawkish, warlike speech you could imagine. And it was broadcast all over the world. He was interrupted with standing ovations and applause. And so everyone assumed that somehow American Jews as a whole were these bellicose, hawkish Cheney supporters. And I knew that wasn't the case. So it occurred to me, the question I've been asking myself over the years, as many of us in sort of our little movement have asked ourselves, polls have always shown that American Jews are far to the left of the organizations that purport to represent them in Washington. When it comes to the West Bank, when it comes to the occupation, when it comes to talking to the PLO, whatever you choose the issue over the last 25 years. So if that's the case, where have all the doves been all of these years?
Yeah, you have you describe your visit to that AIPAC conference in 2005. What did it feel like? Did it feel kind of strange and weird?
Well, I've been to a few of them actually before then and after that. Because, as I say in the book, it's sort of like being a log cabin Republican. You sort of have to know what these people are at. You have to be at the table in order to understand them, and that just felt particularly oppressive to me. And it really sparked me to do some research for this particular book, which was to answer that question first of all: why did we lose and they win? To put it as bluntly as possible, how much power do they actually have, they being what I consider the conventional pro-Israel lobby, and what can be done about it? Most importantly, is it possible to transform the political context in which America's Middle East policy is now made?
Now, a few years ago, a couple of scholars, Walt and Biersheimer, made a big splash with their article and then a book about the Israel lobby, the Zionist lobby in the U.S., What was your reaction to their argument?
Well, a lot of right-wing Jews, and not only right-wing Jews, and Israel supporters and other scholars were angry at them, and because they thought that it was a book filled with shoddy scholarship and that they made too many glib generalizations. And I was frankly disappointed. I had a different reaction because I thought they had an opportunity to really analyze the nuts and bolts of the Israel lobby, and they really didn't do it. They didn't have enough understanding of the nuances, first of all, of the American Jewish community and, frankly, of American policymaking. That said, they opened up a dialogue and a conversation, and I'm very glad they opened it up. And the gist of what they were saying was, of course, true in terms of the power of a certain core of American right-wing Jews to influence American foreign policy. I decided, though, that I needed to sort of give a kind of a dovish Jewish answer to Walt and Mearsheimer, which accepted some of their premises, many of them, but also disagreed with some of them. And the book's not about them, but I did think it had too many flaws, frankly, and that people who objected to it, who also disagreed with the Israel lobby, were caught in a kind of a war of attack ads in the reaction to their paper and their book. And I tried to do a more calm, cool, dispassionate analysis of what the lobby is and what it isn't, what it can accomplish, what it can't accomplish. And
that's not what gets you on TV, though.
No.
But
they got a $750,000 advance.
They did.
Something like that for their book.
You know, my God.
I got enough for a subway ride to BAI.
Yeah, with an unlimited ride card.
Right.
Let's start by looking at that premise. Is there a singular, definite article, the Israel lobby, or is it more complicated than that?
Well, it's much more complicated. I define it in a way that's manageable so that we can figure out how to build an alternative to it, or either from within or without. And to me, the conventional Israel lobby are organizations and or people whose mission in life is to close any possible gaps between the American government's official position and the Israel government's official positions, who are very loath to accept Americans criticizing the Israeli government, and tend to be very isolationist in their tend to want to suppress much contact with the Israel's supposed enemies, whether it's Hezbollah or Hamas or Iran. That's a kind of a vague definition, but it applies to a great many organizations. And that's not representative not only of the American Jewish community as a whole, but it's not even representative of groups that also have a connection, spiritual, emotional, to Israel. There are other groups like the ones I've been connected with for many years that that disagree with that, that think that America needs to have the political leeway to lean on both sides of this conflict rather than one side.
Now, could it be that groups like AIPAC have that kind of influence because they say what the U.S. government, the U.S. power elite wants to hear, that Israel serves a very useful foreign policy purpose for the U.S., and all this notion that Israel is somehow manipulating the U.S. has it all backwards, that Israel is actually very useful to American foreign policy and that the officialdom doesn't want to recognize more diverse or dissenting views?
Well, I've heard that analysis, and I think you could have made that during the Cold War. when it clearly both the arms industry and other industries that frankly benefited from tensions with the Soviet bloc benefited from America's alliance with Israel. And to some extent, that's still true when it comes to weapons trade. But I think that by and large, that time is gone now. And it's a purely – it's a pure game of political pressure using Congress as sort of the lever to manipulate American administrations based on ideological principles. I'm not sure it's really in anybody's interest at this point except for the military industrial establishment, which is obviously very, very large, to continue the conflict. And I don't think most people want to hear what the lobby has to say simply because it's in America's interest. It's in what they perceive to be America's interest. I don't believe that anymore.
And just to take a little detour, but what about the increasing role or passion, passionate support for Israel coming from the Christian right? How much of an influence is that?
Well, they were obviously very important during the Bush administration, the last two Bush administrations. They had, to the extent that politics influenced what he and Rove were doing on the Middle East, they probably had much more direct influence than the American Jewish right. But I don't think they're a whole lot relevant now, not to this guy, not to Obama. He has a centrist and even left-wing evangelical community that's very supportive of him on a variety of issues, including the Middle East. And I don't think he cares at all about the Christian Zionists. They're not going to vote for him, and they're not his people.
I want to return to Obama later on, but before we do that, let's just talk about the list of members of this important lobby. I guess AIPAC is at the top of the list. America-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Who are they and what do they do?
Well, they're the most important group in Washington. They're the only organization in the community except for a fairly recently formed one that's legally entitled to lobby on behalf of legislation and policies related to Israel. Well, none of the others – all the other ones are 501c3 groups. You know what that's about, and they can't do that. AIPAC can lobby. AIPAC has a network of political action committees around the country.
And a lot of money.
Well, AIPAC itself has money, but mostly AIPAC's main political influence is with, as I was about to say, a network of political action committees that it sort of signals quietly, sometimes loudly, usually quietly with a kind of subterfuge and winks and nods. And those political action committees donate money to the folks AIPAC wants them to donate money to. You combine that with individuals, there's a lot of money in the air. But one of the things that I discovered in my book, and which I hope your listeners will realize, is it's actually a very small-time player in all of this, the so-called pro-Israel lobby. The sense that they control the levers and machinery of the American government because of their political contributions is not true. What they control it to the extent that they control it, it's based on the perception that they have a lot of money. And in fact, they don't.
But everybody knows Jews have lots of money, right?
Well, yeah. It's so that you get all of these sort of basic anti-Semitic the anti-Semitic mythos that everyone inherits, Jews and non-Jews, about Jewish money. And it becomes exaggerated in the minds of politicians who are desperate to get the campaign contributions and their political handlers. But if you actually look at the Federal Election Commission records, which I did do for my book, you'll find that they have an impact actually on a small minority of congressional races, very tiny. And even the legends that I grew up with, which say that AIPAC can pour money into the coffers of opponents of politicians they don't like and scare them away, and so everyone's afraid of them, that only happens occasionally.
It's interesting that AIPAC and the rest of the lobby benefits from all these demented cliches of anti-Semitism, like money and power and secrecy and you know, all the classic stuff and the protocols of the Elders of Zion can actually be turned to their advantage.
Yeah. There are, 4.5 million Jews in this country, and a friend of mine whom I quote in the book said, Congress thinks that AIPAC represents all 40 million American Jews.
So what is the – how do they create this mystique, this sense of power? Is it just – you have a quote from Jimmy Breslin about smoke and mirrors, right? There's a lot of that involved?
I would say more than 50% of it is smoke and mirrors. A lot of it is the projection of resources, the projection of political capital, the projection that of the image that they will punish a politician if he goes against them, whereas in fact they usually don't. And – it's a perception game, which is in Washington, there's the line between the perception that you can do something and your ability to do it is almost indistinguishable, but it's not quite the same thing. And I mean, every other lobby, every other political movement in Washington depends on perceptions to prop up its power. These people are just masters at it, and they've been doing it a long time. But it's not just smoke and mirrors. It's also a certain amount of it's also money. It's also a certain amount of nudginess. They frankly are very annoying.
You say that congresspeople have been in office for a while just don't want to be annoyed, right? They want to be left alone. They want to be lobbied and troubled.
Yes.
And AIPAC is very good at lobbying and annoying and troubling people.
Yes. And so it's a combination of factors, including just profound ignorance of the Middle East, and profound ignorance, frankly, of what America's interests in the Middle East should be and are, that account for some of its power.
Now, who else is there besides AIPAC that throwing weight around?
Well, there's to the right of AIPAC is the Zionist Organization of America, which is one of the more vocal pro-settler organizations that is has far less resources than AIPAC, but they have a certain amount of power in Congress. They also have their own lobbying efforts, and to them, AIPAC is a bunch of namby-pambies that I could say this, I think, for a WBAI because he'll never listen to it. The head of that organization actually phoned me when he read my book and said, "We're not a far-right organization. We're actually in the center. Everyone else moved to the left."
What's his name?
Mort Klein.
Oh, yeah. A friend of mine that was in a debate with him a couple of years ago. He said he's just an absolutely demented fellow.
Yes. Well, you said that. I didn't.
I said that. Well, he said that. I'm just reporting what he reported.
But the most troubling part of this is right in what I would consider to be, at least on this issue, when compared with other American Jewish organizations, there is the ADL, the American Jewish Congress, the American Jewish Committee, and other fairly well-known establishment organizations, which are fairly liberal on a lot of domestic policies, not all of them, and they tend to be. At least that's been their tradition. But when it comes to Israel, they tend to be very quiet when it's time to criticize Israel, and they tend to be loath to have any distance between the positions of the two governments. So they're also part of the lobby to the extent that they passively accept whatever AIPAC wants them to do.
Speaking with Dan Fleshler, who is the author of Transforming America's Israel Lobby, just out from Potomac Books. So the perception is that if any politician or even a writer, look what happened, or an ex-president like Jimmy Carter, if you say anything that's critical of Israel, the lobby will come down on you like a ton of bricks and you will be out of office or disgraced or not invited onto TV anymore. You're saying that this perception is quite exaggerated.
I think it's exaggerated. Of course, there's some truth to it. And as long as there's a kernel of truth to anything in Washington, people are going to assume that it's true. Obviously, Howard Dean used the word even-handed, and there was a guerrilla campaign, mostly by Republican operatives, actually, to slam him when he was running for president. So people remembered what happened to Howard Dean. Cynthia McKinney and Earl Hilliard, two African-American congresspeople, had a lot of American Jews donated a lot of money to their opponents. So people assume because of some of the things they said about Israel and other things. And so people assume that that's the signal that everyone else needs to understand. But in fact, there are a great many people in Congress and a great many other politicians and a great many writers who take a very independent stance on the Middle East and nothing happens to them. One of them, for example, is Jim Moran. You'll recall he, a Virginia Democrat, who said that very early on that protection of Israel was one of the main motives for us invading Iraq. And he was slammed publicly by the other Democrats, let alone the pro-Israel lobby. So if there's anyone who should have been sort of defeated by all this vast apparatus of money and power that the lobby supposedly has, it would have been Jim Moran. He's been reelected twice. Robert Byrd, you know, the dean of the Senate, he rails constantly against unconditional aid to Israel. Nothing happens to him. The reason nothing happens to any of those people, and there are many more, is that they can't be defeated. So AIPAC doesn't go after them. They only go after politicians that are vulnerable. Right now, our president is not vulnerable, either obviously in his base among Democrats, in the American Jewish community, or among the wider American people. They're not going to go after him. Or if they do, they're going to find it very, very difficult to figure out a formula in which to express their dissatisfaction. And to me, that's actually very promising because it will give him a lot more wiggle room than any president in history has had to do the right thing on the Middle East, to be more even-handed.
Now, what do you make of him? Because sometimes he seems like he's moving policy in a different direction. Other times it seems like he's genuflecting to the official line, talking about moving the capital of Jerusalem and all that sort of thing. What do you make of the direction the Obama administration is taking?
I'm very encouraged. If you are against the occupation and you're concerned about the suffering of the Palestinian people, there are things that any American administration is going to say that are going to upset you. That's just the way it is. And I'm a practical person, though. Compared to his predecessors, he's taken a much more forceful stance against the settlements than any except for Carter. And he seems to be moving in a direction where it's clear, not just to the Israeli government, but to the Israeli people, that he's not going to stand for their recalcitrance anymore. But in doing that, I mean, you have to take people where they're at. And so in doing that, he also has to give a certain level of reassurance to the Israeli people that he is concerned with their core security requirements, which much of the far left just sort of disregards and is unhappy with. He has to do that in order to gain support for some of the other provisions that he's going to ask, some of the other actions he's going to ask Netanyahu to take. Now, we're a long way from getting anywhere close to peace. I don't mean to suggest that. I just think the signs are promising. One of the other things that any president has to do, I've learned, is to reassure that portion of the American Jewish community that is opposed to the occupation, wants a Palestinian state, but is worried about Israeli security and Israeli safety, that he's on their side. Bill Clinton did that to some extent, and he's doing it quite well. So what the left might think of as sort of a side that seemed like the same old line, those are just – I think that's rhetoric. As one of the consultants in the book I quoted says, you have to give them rhetoric and then do the right thing.
We've only got another minute left. I'm sorry to do this. But we've spoken mostly about the Israel lobby, not the transforming part. But in a minute or so, how can we sort of reduce the death grip of AIPAC on policy and consciousness?
In a minute, huh? Well, we already have a growing movement not only of American Jewish but of Christian and Muslim organizations in Washington that have started to work together and are united. And they are doing things on legislation that has never been done before at the nitty-gritty level of domestic politics. There needs to be a lot more people, but frankly, within the American Jewish community, speaking out, getting off their duffs and supporting them. I think that's begun to happen. And I think that other Americans of all faith groups have the opportunity to join together with us, frankly, and tell both Congress and the American president that it's time to have a more balanced policy.
Even Americans of no faith groups like myself.
Yes.
All right. I've been speaking with Dan Fleshler, who is the author of Transforming America's Israel Lobby, The Limits of Its Power and Potential for Change. And if you want to hear more about how to transform the thing or anatomy of the thing, please do pick up this fine book just published by Potomac Books. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks,
Dan,
for having me.
And good luck with the book.
Thanks.
All right. Let's take a break for Station ID, and then we'll be back to talk about Iran.
WBAI, New York. We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
And this is Doug Henwood, the show Behind the News, and you can, aside from hearing WBAI on the radio at 99.5 FM, you can also check out our website at WBAI.org. And while there, don't forget to click the donate button. The new spirit at WBAI feels good and is growing, and you can contribute to it by helping us pay our bills. And I can say with some conviction that you wouldn't be wasting your money by doing that. So please do visit the website and click that donate button. All right, and now we're going to take a musical break for a little Iranian hip-hop.
Masih اطلاعات و دم کوچه با دستمال یزدی به قول مریم حول میشه تو لباس کردی یه حاله مقدس رو سر مترسک یکی بزغاله میبینه همه رو یکی هم شک همه سیر و مغز پیر و انقلاب مخملی شریک کتشلواری و چگوارای فکری سیاسی های مست و مستای معتقد دکتر و پروفسور با پیشوند سید مفتی بی ریشه و ریشه مفتی امت گشنه کرم و کلام کذب و کشف و کتاب کهنه دولت بیمار ملت بیزار مدیر غائب جوون و جلق و جهاد اکبر و امام نائب شهید زنده و زنده های مرد بی کفن شما و چراغ دین چلغوزای بی وطن فردوسی خط امامی با سربند یا زهرا حافظ یه بسیجی کلچ به دست سر کوچه ها حقوق بشر بشر بی حق حرفای شیرین تطبیق.
And that was from a soundtrack to a YouTube video of the demonstrations in the streets of Tehran in the wake of the election last week, which saw the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, reelected by what some regard, including me, as an implausibly large margin of 62 or 63%. And that is sparking enormous protests in Iran and leading to what looks like quite a possible interesting political transformation in that country. And so trying to understand what's going on there, I thought I'd check in with Hamid Dabashi, who is a professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University, a member of their Middle Eastern Studies department, and been on this program several times before, talking about his History of Iran, which was published by the New Press back in 2007, People Interrupted. And he's a prolific author of many other books as well, I think 18 of them. You can check out his website at hamiddabashi.com, Hamiddabashi.com. And he is a thoughtful and sophisticated analyst of things Iranian. So, interview recorded earlier. Hamid Dabashi. Welcome, Hamid. I guess the first question is, do you think the election was stolen?
Well, I just wrote a piece in which I have argued that that the election was stolen is now a social fact. And whether or not it was actually stolen, it is a moot and academic question. It is a question of the crying wolf. This government and this regime has been crying wolf for so many times that even if indeed they have not stolen this particular election, people believe they have. Now, having said that, we have to go back to the demographic of the election. Iranian society is very, very fractured, Doc, and the Islamic Republic and Ahmadinejad in particular have a certain undeniable appeal to certain segments of the society. By now it has become kind of proverbial to say the poor, the peasantry, etc., but that is not entirely true. That is, if you look at the composition of the people who have voted for alternative opposition candidates, the reformist candidates, namely Mir Hossein Mousavi and Mehdi Karroubi, you have, in fact, among their supporters a cross-section of the society, both from rural areas and from the urban poor. And then, but the most fascinating thing that has started surfacing is that what we're witnessing in the streets of Tehran, this massive millions of people pouring into the streets, actually includes some of those who voted for Ahmadinejad. That is, the movement, I don't know what at this stage to call it yet, but I simply call it the movement. The movement now has assumed proportions and dimensions and a character beyond simply a reaction and an opposition to the stated results.
Do you have any idea what the regime might have been thinking? If you're going to steal an election, do it with 51%, not an implausible 62. Did they overplay their hand? Was there some overconfidence involved?
Well, the thing is, one way to explain that is this absolutely massive turnout. The Iranian population is 72 million. The actual turnout that both the opposition and the regime declared and are actually unanimous is about, out of the 46 million eligible voters, more than 40 million have voted, namely 80 to 82% of eligible voters have voted. That is, it was so massive. And here goes to the psychology of the insecurity of the regime. every one of these presidential or parliamentary elections, the regime wants to use it as an indication of how popular it is. So they wanted, in fact, immediately the reaction of the leader, Khamenei, etc., was, oh, look how popular we are with this massive participation. But the fact of it is, if you look at the psychology of pre-election period, particularly among the two reformist candidates, they were so scared that they will have a repetition of 2005 and people will boycott it, that they went through all sorts of maneuvering to make sure that the actual turnout is huge, because they were convinced that if those who boycotted the election last presidential election, you remember 2005, in the second round of the election, Ahmadinejad had 15 million and Rafsanjani, his opposite side, 5 million, which means 20 million out of then in 2005, almost 40 million. So the opposition was counting on a massive outpour, and it turned out people were voting just right, left, and center. And so if the election is rigged, and we have to be very cautious, it was rigged proportionate to the massive participation in the actual voting.
There's some on the Western left who view Ahmadinejad as a great hero in the fight against American imperialism, and so they are very eager to see him as some sort of domestic populist who has greatly aided the poor of Iran and is imposing or implementing some sort of progressive economic agenda. Is there any truth to that? How has the working class been doing?
As you know, the fact that there's at least some country in the region resisting the belligerence of particularly the Bush administration, everybody was happy. But I've been looking at the presidential campaigns and listening to him intently over the past 3 weeks or now. Listening, not just reading him, what he says, just his demeanor and his the way that he carries himself. I have absolutely no concern or question in my mind. He's a charlatan. He's a populist. He's a charlatan. I'll give you an example. In the course of a presidential election debate, Mousavi tells him something to the effect, why do you go around the world questioning Holocaust, proven fact, suffering of 6 million human beings? Why do you embarrass us in front of the world and raise questions about Holocaust? And the way he responds, oh, really? So is that your position? So you're siding with the Zionists and the imperialists and taking issue with me? So it is at that level, or the way that, for example, he fabricates dossiers for his opponents, so that he's a demagogue and a populist, etc., I have no question in my mind. But now, if you go to his economic policies, you have double-digit inflation, you have endemic unemployment. But he has been systematically advocating a series of governmental subsidies for the rural and urban poor, and that has made him very very popular with those segments of the society. Now, this to me is comparable to when we had economic meltdown here and you had all of these stimulus packages given to banks and car factories and such. There were many concerns. Why are you bailing out these companies? Why aren't you bailing out people? So imagine if Obama or before him Bush were giving tax rebates instead of these monumental figures given to companies and so forth. It would have made Bush very popular with his constituency. This is what Ahmadinejad has been doing. Iranian economy, as you recall, Doug, is 85% oil-based. Oil-based economy is not labor-intensive. Oil-based economy is always at the mercy of the fluctuation of price of oil around the globe. That fluctuation, particularly in this global economic meltdown, has meant that most basic necessities are at the mercy of governmental subsidies. And instead of generating jobs or thinking of prolonged plans, he has been providing government-sponsored subsidies. And now, you may take issue with that economically, as some, but the fact is that there is a constituency that that responds positively to that sort of economic options.
But it doesn't really do anything to transform the economy over the longer term.
Oh, absolutely not. But then if you go back and look at, for example, his predecessor of Khatami, for 8 years, he didn't have a particularly attractive alternative. He didn't generate job either, and despite the fact that during his administration, you did have quite a number of occasions that the price of oil went up and he could have generated jobs, which leads me to conclude what we are witnessing is not just about economic factors. Despite the fact, I'll give you a very, very fascinating statistic, that the people between the ages of 15 and 35, you have the highest unemployment among these two, this age group, almost 70% according to one economist. Give you another statistic, 63% of university entrants plus are women, but women are only 12.3% of the labor force. So the economic pressure is absolutely tremendous, but so is social cause, and the two have combined plus additional factors and led to this movement that we are seeing it.
Let's talk a little bit about the opposition. Mousavi is certainly no Iranian Jesse Ventura or Ross Perot or Ralph Nader. He's not an outsider who's the kind of guy who's going to overturn things, is he?
Well, no, he's no Jesse Ventura or anything of that sort. But what and he has been the prime minister during the war. The left has very, very bad memory of him, Iranian left, because of his execution and crackdown on the opposition, because of his the projects that he had with university, getting rid of oppositional people in the university. So he has quite a number of dead closets, skeletons in his closet that nobody now talks about. But then what happened after the war, after he was the prime minister for during the Iran-Iraq war, he went into seclusion. He abandoned politics altogether. It was some kind of a soul-searching happened to him for almost 20 years. He became an abstract painter. He started reading. He didn't want to have anything to do with the politics. Now he has come back after considerable hesitation. And then my guess is that the movement is making something out of him other than he was or even if he, he expected. Economically, he's on the Islamic left. He's a socialist in his principles. He's a follower of the late Ali Shariati, who was a Muslim revolutionary socialist. So is his wife. So he's not going to follow that. Of that, I'm convinced, the new liberal economics that will make Milton Friedman sing and dance in his grave. But my guess is that if this movement has any snowball chance in hell to succeed in some meaningful measures, it is only if it unfolds in the direction of nonviolent civil disobedience. If it unfolds in that way, and as I have said a number of occasions, he has an opportunity to pay back for his sins and emerge as a Martin Luther King, as a Nelson Mandela, as a Gandhi. People are now referring to him as a Gandhi, because the in my judgment, the period of ideological revolutions or militant revolutions, at least for Iran, at least in this composition of what I'm seeing, is over. Is not evident. So on the other hand, I'm not convinced that this is somebody has just said is a middle class revolution. That to me doesn't sound correct either.
I'm speaking with Hamid Dabashi, who is a professor in the Middle Eastern Studies Department at Columbia. Yeah, I want to follow up on that, which is that there's some people on the Western left who are sympathetic to Ahmadinejad were saying that the opposition to his rule was an upper-class thing. It was cosmopolitan liberals in North Tehran, and the masses, the proletarians and the peasants were very solidly behind Ahmadinejad. You're suggesting that that model is not really appropriate.
No, and in fact, I would even argue that the description would have been accurate in 2005 election. In 2005, my argument was that during the post-war reconstruction period, the 8 year of Rafsanjani's presidency between 1989 and 1997, you had the production of a new wealthy class, the nouveau riche and such. And then when Khatami came to power between 1997 and 2005, 5, you had a social agenda precisely for these sorts of people, people who were neoliberal in their economics and were for social reform, freedom of press, and that sort of thing. Come presidential election of 2005, the new constituency that ultimately brought Ahmadinejad to office consisted of those who were not beneficiary of Rafsanjani's economic projects and couldn't care less about Khatami's social reform, and thus they voted for Ahmadinejad. But now, when I look at the composition of this particular movement, number one, Mousavi is not a reformist. Khatami is a reformist, and Khatami has supported him. So he's not in the reformist camp in the strict sense of the term. Number two, he's a socialist through and through in his economics. In fact, there was some consideration that the reformist youth will not vote for him precisely because of his socialist background. And one explanation as to why is it that in the first round of election, Karubi entered was to bring the you know, precisely that what I call them Gucci revolutionaries into the fold, and then in the second round they will go and support Mousavi. So, in my judgment, between 2005 and 2009, and between and considering the character of who Mousavi is, we need to reconsider that assessment of what Ahmadinejad represents.
Iran has a very young population and a rapidly growing population. There must be an awful lot of young folks who are kind of tired of being ruled by a clique of mullahs, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I have no question whatsoever. I've been looking at Facebooks. I've been looking at Twitters. I have been looking at new films that are coming out. There's a magnificent underground rap music inside Iran. This is a whole new generation dog. As you just said, about 70% of the Iranian population is under the age of 30, which means they have no memory of the Islamic Revolution of 1979 and couldn't give a hoot about those who do. This is a very young generation. Is left or liberal, voting for Mousavi or not voting for Mousavi. They are just sick and tired of being ruled by this. And then by this clique of mullahs, ideologically committed, being alienated, or in their name, Holocaust being denied, or belligerent position on regional politics, and so forth and so on. So you and I may not actually agree with the politics of that these, or the, even the economic preferences of some of these young Iranians, but that's besides the point. The fact is that they're sick and tired of the look of this government. And for example, some of the signs that I read, or slogans that I hear from these, and the chants and such, and songs that are coming out of these demonstrations, they all indicate a deep desire to come back to the fold of history. They are internet savvy. They want to be part of a global scene, and this sort of constitution of Iran as a pariah sicks and tires them, and they just want to get out of that.
Well, who is the domestic audience for the Holocaust denying and the saber rattling?
I'm not sure it is domestic at all. It is a degeneration of a historical position of Iran in support of the Palestinian cause that now has degenerated into this ludicrous position. In fact, when Ahmadinejad had orchestrated this competition about cartoons denying the Holocaust, I remember the absolutely magnificent cartoonist who, in fact, lived in New York for many years and recently died, and you have some of the most unbelievable depictions of the horrors of Holocaust by this cartoonist. His name is Ardashir Mohassef. He just passed away, and Asia Society had a major retrospective on him. So the only explanation that I have is a degeneration of a pro-Palestinian position into this sheer stupidity.
I would imagine that Israel would be very happy with Ahmadinejad staying in office.
Oh, absolutely. The night before the election on 12th of June, AIPAC pushed a button, and a number of their U.S. congressmen started a move towards further sanctions against Iran in the U.S. Congress. And I was petrified when I read that piece of news, because I knew more sanctions against Iran equals a vote for Ahmadinejad. many Israeli observers have come. I've been following it in Haaretz regularly, that first of all, there is nothing particularly wrong with this election, and they much prefer Ahmadinejad to Mousavi, because Ahmadinejad is what Ahmadinejad is. And in fact, Ahmadinejad's sheer act of stupidity in Durban 2, you remember, in Geneva, helped to whitewash the massacre of Palestinians in Gaza in December 2008 and January 2009. So Israelis love him. I mean, not all Israelis. Today, Gideon Levy wrote absolutely a magnificent editorial in Haaretz, siding with the demonstrations and saying how envious he is that they don't have anything like that in Israel.
What do you think of the U.S. government's position so far?
I think Obama has been wonderful, Doc. He has been very, very cautious, both lending support to the demonstrators, but in a very cautious way. Any other open embracing of the movement by official America, by American officials, is a kiss of death. I just was in a debate with a Republican congressman from Indiana, and now these hypocrites come and say that the U.S. should openly advocate support for the demonstrators. It is American people, particularly icons of the civil rights movement, in my judgment, Jesse Jackson, Reverend Sharpton, etc. The more public figures, not official figures, artists, the people who put together, for example, the video on behalf of Obama that then Iranians imitated for on behalf of Mousavi and is all over the YouTube. American left, progressive thinkers, artists, intellectuals, civil rights icons, those Americans need to go to the support of this movement. But U.S. government, president, Congress, absolutely not.
Oh, of course, this always this debased journalistic practice at the end of the interview, asking you to gaze into a crystal ball. But where do you see this movement going? Is something really transformational happening in Iran now?
Absolutely. But how transformational? In what particular direction? I've been keeping a daily diary on my website, trying to gauge it. The only way that right now today I'm petrified, because they are shutting down foreign journalists. They are cracking down on websites and Twitter and Facebook and such, which always, as you know, is a prelude to a bloody crackdown. This is not a guerrilla movement. This is not a political party movement. This is not something that is orchestrated from outside. This is internal. This is grassroots. This is inborn. And you have, first of all, you have more women and more young people than men or old people in this election. They don't have. They have to be creative in terms of their communication, because their communication systems are constantly harassed and interrupted. To me, the only way that this movement can achieve certain limited and perhaps tangible results, if it spreads beyond these street demonstrations into civil disobedience in other segments of the society. Example. The day before yesterday, a number of staffs, physicians and nurses in a hospital poured onto the street and started giving statistics of how many people were injured and killed in that hospital the night before. You had a spontaneous demonstration. People gathered around them, applauded them, etc. Second example, I saw another video of a spontaneous demonstration in a Tehran subway, starting into chanting anti-governmental slogans. So it has to go, and then the chancellor of Shiraz University has resigned. The demonstrations are spreading outside Tehran into other major cities, and the only way that there are signs of it, that this might succeed if it turns into nonviolent and civil disobedient acts. Otherwise, any other sort of scenario will be bloodily repressed with massive casualties, very scary scenario.
And I presume the regime has firm control of the security apparatus?
Oh, absolutely. There are three strata of security and military apparatus, the Hezbollah, the Basij, and the Pasdaran. And the Pasdaran yesterday actually issued a warning that the penalty for disregarding the governmental instructions is execution. So now they have, initially they brought their anti-riot police, then plain clothes, then what is called basij, and now pasdaran has entered the scene. And then they have given this thing that 646 items of discrepancies has been identified. So there is a carrot and a stick operation here. But I'm not sure if it works. That it's from the volume of what I'm seeing and the strategies and the cross-section of society participating, I don't think this is manageable by or something to be completely cracked down without consequences. Even if the Mousavi backs down and comes to some sort of understanding, which I very much doubted, he's an aging revolutionary and he has done things that he wants to pay back for. This will not die down.
I've been speaking with Hamid Dabashi, who is a professor of Iranian studies and comparative literature at Columbia University and a prolific author. His most recent books include Post-Orientalism, Knowledge and Power in the Time of Terror, Islamic Liberation Theology, Resisting the Empire, and Iran, A People Interrupted, A History of His Native Country. Dabashi's website is at hamiddabashi.com, hamiddabashi.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. Let's go out with this, also from the fine new album by Sonic Youth, The Eternal. This one's called Sacred Trickster. Till next week, bye.